From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, attracting big conventions to Detroit means opening more hotels.
Just as we've had a lot of new restaurants and a lot of new apartment buildings, the hotel market is coming back too as part of this boom.
Exploring social change through science fiction.
We have authors who are not only envisioning, but they're doing the work to build a different future or to build their version of justice, their version of equity.
We check in with Michigan's International Dark Sky Park.
Unfortunately, a truly dark, naturally dark night sky is a diminishing resource around the world.
And mark the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination.
Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, urged him, don't go out, because they had received assassination threats.
Those stories and more. 150 years ago this night, Abraham Lincoln was shot during a night out at the theater. Just what happened in those agonizing hours between the shooting and his death?
If he did recover, there would have been profound brain damage. It was quite an explosive event.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, a medical look at one of the most important events in American history. But first, there's a hotel boom going on in downtown Detroit. Once abandoned buildings are now new hotels, or will be. Will these plans give Detroit too many hotel rooms or not enough? And what's the furor about the two hotels near the new Red Wings Arena site just north of downtown? Detroit Free Press writer John Gallagher is with us now. Always good to have you with us, John.
Well, thank you.
Let us start with what's happening between Detroit City Council and Olympia Entertainment, which, of course, is the Ilitch family, over these two abandoned buildings that were once hotels near the planned arena site. Bring us up to speed.
Sure. Well, the deal to create not only the new arena for the Red Wings, but the entire district that'll surround them, was negotiated, you know, by the city with the Ilitch family and then presented more or less as a fait accompli to City Council, which has to approve it. Now, the reality of how you negotiate these deals, they're very complicated, they're very big, lots of moving parts. And so council is sort of given something, a package that's sort of an up or down, you know, vote, and council would prefer to have more of a say in what's going to happen. And the sticking point is what happens to these two vacant hotels that date from about the 1920s or so, the Eddystone and the Park Avenue. And what the Ilitches have agreed to do is to save the Eddystone and repurpose it as housing and tear down the other one. And council's sticking point seems to be, as of this week, that they want an absolute ironclad guarantee that the Eddystone will, in fact, be redeveloped. And they don't want to just take the Ilitches' word for it, basically. And so that's kind of where we are. And I think some of it is sort of council wanting to flex its muscles and have a say in this process and not just, you know, be given a plan to sort of rubber stamp.
And one might note that probably the Ilitches didn't get where they are today by just shaking hands on a deal. I think one might say this is a fair demand from the council.
Yeah, and I think that part of it is that, you know, there's a lot of public money going up front into the arena project, you know, assembling the land and paying for close to half of the cost of the arena project. And what we get, what we the public get out of it, is that the Ilitches will spend $200 million to develop the rest of the district, the housing and the restaurants and the entertainment venues. And so there's a lot of public money up front with the hoped-for return on the back end of a lot of new development and new jobs and new tax base. So council, I think, again, wants to be there, you know, wants to be part of the process and say, you know, show us the money, you know, let us be part of this deal and not just, you know, don't expect us to just rubber stamp this.
Now, is this anything that could conceivably tank this arena proposal?
Well, I think that that's unlikely. I think they'll probably work it out probably fairly soon in the next couple of weeks or so. Basically, they need to, if this, in fact, is the only final sticking point, they just need to come up with some language that'll satisfy everybody. The odds of it actually blowing up the whole deal, I think, are pretty remote. But, you know, anything's possible.
Let's pivot over to your recent story on the blossoming downtown Detroit hotel scene. And you take us through the occupancy rates for downtown Detroit hotels, which I think is important to understand as we look ahead to what might be coming. What was the occupancy rate at the depths of the Great Recession? And what was it for 2014 as auto sales go up and unemployment goes down?
Right. Well, the hotels generally need about 60 to 70% occupancy to break even. Above that level, they, you know, they make a profit. Below that, they usually lose money. For years and years, Detroit was at best at about a 60% market during the Great Recession, probably well under that. Now they're well above 60% or getting there, probably in the 65 range. So they're getting to the point where they can start to make money again. And I think, you know, you don't look at the hotel market in isolation. It's part of the general boom downtown. We're getting all this new housing, all these new developments by Dan Gilbert and the Illiches, you know, a lot of new work at Cobo Center. Cobo Center's been completely revamped. They're just about done with that, you know, four-year, $300 million renovation and expansion at Cobo. And so we're starting to see a lot of new conventions and trade shows sign up to come into Detroit. So I think that's led to the promise that we're going to need more hotel rooms, and that's why we're beginning to see at least four or five new projects on the drawing boards that'll be built, you know, if they all happen, and will be built in the next couple of years.
And we've got about, as you said in your piece for the Free Press, about 3,500 rooms downtown right now, about, and that's twice as many as there were in 2000. With all of these promised new things coming down the pike, how much more could that add?
Probably another 500 to 700 on top of that. So it's still, I mean, it's still a relatively modest market compared to, you know, Chicago or New York. Chicago's got, I don't know, 40,000 or 50,000 rooms downtown and a much, you know, more robust convention business than Detroit does. But Detroit's, you know, lining up to really pick up its convention business to be one of the major ones in the Midwest anyway. And I think that, you know, another 500 to 700 hotel rooms would be very helpful, you know, as if the market continues to pick up. The danger, of course, is that if there's a recession or something else bad happens and we don't fill up these rooms, then you might start to see some, you know, some new hotels get built and then, you know, not make it financially. So that's always a danger. But at the moment, the market's looking up, and so we're getting a lot of this interest in these smaller boutique hotels. So if the Renaissance Center, the Marriott at the Renaissance, has, you know, well over 1,000 rooms, something like 1,400 rooms. A lot of these new hotels would be in the 100 to 150 room variety.
Take us through some of these latest projects, the ones either here or that are promised and are coming.
Well, one that just opened, the Aloft Hotel in the David Whitney Building. The David Whitney Building is a 1920 era office building, and it was vacant for many, many years, 20 years or so, and it's been remade as a boutique hotel, the Aloft Hotel, a little over 100 rooms. Some residential apartments are being finished at this point. They'll be occupied this year, and then there'll be a restaurant and some other retail on the ground floor. So that's one. That's near Grand Circus Park. One of the more interesting ones is that the old fire department headquarters across the street from Cobo is being remade as a new hotel. And they're working on their tax credits and other financing, and that should start construction, if not this year, then maybe by next spring or
so. I'm excited about that one, John. I love that old building. I'm so glad it's getting new life and it's not going to be just allowed to decay.
Right. It's one of the more interesting architectural buildings downtown, and yeah, I'm really happy for that one. And then the old Wurlitzer building, which again is another very slim 1920s era office building, is just got the go-ahead to be remade as another hotel, another boutique hotel with about 100 rooms and retail on the first floor. So those are some of them.
Yeah.
And then there's more up in Midtown. So there's a lot of, you know, just as we've had a lot of new restaurants and a lot of new apartment buildings, we're getting, you know, the hotel market is coming back too as part of this boom.
What has to happen, John Gallagher, to keep these current hotels open? You've got, you know, the Book Cadillac and the Fort Shelby. And so to keep those open, the ones coming down the pike, and attract new ones.
Well, it's got to be more than the auto show. I mean, the pattern for many years is that the auto show would come in January and fill up all the hotels all over town. And occasionally you'd have a really special event like the Super Bowl, which would do the same thing. But you've got to have year-round convention and trade business and business, you know, business travel. And so the Convention Bureau is working, you know, really hard to make Detroit attractive. I think the Cobo Center renovations have been part of that. The Convention and Visitors Bureau is working really hard to, you know, to attract new shows and showing some results. I mean, the number of new shows goes up every year. So they've just got to keep selling Detroit as the kind of vibrant market that people would like to come to and visit as part of, you know, part of doing business. So we've just got to keep up that effort.
Meantime, out in the burbs, let's say Dearborn, it used to be if you were an entertainer playing downtown, if you're the Rolling Stones, you would stay at the Hyatt Regency. Or if you're Cher, I remember her staying at the Ritz-Carlton. But that's not the case any longer, is it?
Right. Well, I think Detroit's hotel market in general, not just downtown, but overall, was overbuilt for a while. I think the recession hit us very hard, as we all know. And I think some of the hotels just didn't make it. So, and of course, now as some of those properties were getting a little older, a little tired, and the market is shifting more downtown. So I think that you're going to see some shakeout, as they say, where some of the older properties not doing as well, and some of that market shifting to the greater downtown area. So that's an interesting development. I suspect that property will be remade in some way. Someone will take it and renovate it. But we'll see. We'll see how that works out.
Detroit Free Press writer John Gallagher. As always, thanks so much, John.
You betcha. Anytime. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 150 years ago today, the 16th president of the United States decided that an evening at the theater was just what he needed. Well, we all know how Abraham Lincoln's night at Ford's Theater in Washington ended with a bullet fired by assassin John Wilkes Booth. But let's get a better idea of just what happened during those long hours overnight at a nearby boarding house where doctors tried and failed to treat the president's head wound. University of Michigan physician and medical historian Dr. Howard Markell is with us once again, and this time to tell us more about the tragic last hours of Abraham Lincoln. And Howard, there is every reason for Lincoln to feel like a good night out was in order, wasn't there?
Absolutely. Just about 6 days earlier was the famous truce at Appomattox Courthouse between General Lee and General Grant, and that signaled the end of probably the worst chapter in American history, the Civil War.
And yet things were kind of working against the president going.
They were. I mean, there were a lot of angry people, hence the Civil War, and he had a lot of threats. And in fact, several cabinet officers were worried about him. Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, urged him, don't go out, because they had received assassination threats, several of them, that day.
And Mrs. Lincoln had a migraine?
Yes, she always did. She was a very sickly woman, and she tried to beg off. And Lincoln himself was, understandably exhausted from all the work of the past 4 years. But he thought the play was An American Cousin, which was a hit farce comedy. And he thought, this is just the tonic we need, an evening out. And he also was confident that his bodyguards would protect him.
As well as these signs of perhaps not going, warnings and Mrs. Lincoln's headache, the president had a rather prescient dream, didn't he?
This is probably the strangest part of the tale. About 3 days before the assassination, he told Ward Hill Lehman, his friend, I had this strange dream. I went into the East Room and there was a funeral going on. And I asked the soldier guarding the casket, who died? And the soldier said, the president was murdered. And that startled Lincoln from his sleep, and he woke up and he said, that really annoyed me for some time. So that is a pretty strange dream and a theme in history that often truth is stranger than fiction.
So off he goes with Mrs. Lincoln in tow and gets up into that box. And tell us a little more about the bodyguard.
Well, the bodyguard, his regular bodyguard was a man named Ward Hill Lehman, and he was quite good, but he had the evening off. And so John Parker, who was a police guard, was elected to be the bodyguard that evening. He was, we'd call him an alcoholic. Mm. He had quite a taste for whiskey. And during intermission before the third act, he went downstairs to the Star Saloon to quench his thirst. So he actually left the box unguarded.
And here's the president having no idea that's happened. We all know very well what happened with John Wilkes Booth coming in from behind, and he fired a gun. What happened to the president? What did that do to the president?
John Wilkes Booth entered the box, fired his Derringer pistol right behind the left ear of Lincoln's head, and it tore through his brain. Lincoln slumped forward, and Mrs. Lincoln obviously screamed. They had guests that evening, Major Henry Rathbone and his fiancée, Clara Harris. And so Major Rathbone got up and tried to struggle with John Wilkes Booth, but John Wilkes Booth also had a dagger and stabbed the major. And then historians tend to argue, at what point did he yell the famous sick temper Tyrannus thus always to tyrants. Yep. Now, he may have said that in the box. He may have said it as he famously leapt down to the stage.
Breaking his leg.
Breaking his leg, although some people argue, did he break his leg then or did he break his leg later on? But he certainly injured his leg and had to limp out. Other people said he said, the South is avenged or I have done it, which brings great interest to the whole notion of eye or ear witnesses. Mm-hmm. But he did indeed jump to the stage yelling something and then ran out and thus initiating probably the greatest manhunt in American history. But it's really the next several hours that I find fascinating about Lincoln's ultimate demise.
And you found out that the doctor who cared for him initially was a baby doctor. He was brand new, only 6 weeks out of medical school.
Yeah. Well, I'm a baby doctor because I'm a pediatrician. But he was a young guy, a newly minted doctor. Charles Leal, who had just graduated 6 weeks earlier from the Bellevue Hospital Medical School, which was one of the finest in the land at the time. He had heard Lincoln speak that morning, and he was so impressed by the president, and then he had read he was going to see American Cousin, that Dr. Leal decided to join the audience. So he was right there, and he got to the scene first. He felt around the skull, around President Lincoln's skull with his hand, and realized that there was a gunshot wound right at the base of the skull on the left side. Now, he used unwashed and ungloved hands, and that's because nobody knew about microbes or germ theory, and there were no such thing as surgical gloves. So that was quite the common way you would find out about
it. Probe away and see what you find.
Exactly, and he could dislodge a little bit of a clot right at the base of Lincoln's skull, and he asked for some brandy and water to try to revive the president. But it was quite clear very quickly that this was a mortal wound.
And he was then carried across the street to the famous boarding house.
Yes, he was joined by two other doctors, and they decided to carry the president to Peterson's boarding house, which is still there, mm-hmm. and you can tour it.
Did that a few years ago in that back bedroom.
And there was a back
bedroom. Tiny little room.
Yep, and the person who lodged in that room was out for the evening. And Lincoln, of course, was so famously tall that they had to remove the foot of the bed and lie him diagonally so that he could be comfortable. And then there were several doctors, as well as Robert Lincoln, President Lincoln's son, and Mary Lincoln, his wife, as well as several advisors in the room for the last hours, trying to make the president comfortable, but also could you remove the bullet, could you remove the pieces of the bone and so on. But nothing really worked for the poor president.
There were actually documents that were found not too long ago that really helped illuminate what happened in those hours.
Yeah, in 2012, a researcher for the Lincoln Papers Project, her name is Helena Papiano, and she was going through the ledgers of the Surgeon General's office, which are really these large ledgers where a clerk handwrites and copies whatever letters they got because there was no typewriters in. Mm-hmm. And she found a 22-page report by Dr. Leal written literally hours after the events. Now, there are seven reports by Dr. Leal. Five were written in 1865, one in 1867, and one in 1909. That's the most embellished version, by the way.
So it got a little more embellished as the years went on.
And Leal becomes a lot more primary with each telling of the tale. But historians were amazed in 2012 when this was found in the National Archives because it was literally written a few hours after the president died at 7:20 a.m. on April 15th, 150 years ago.
And in those papers, there's descriptions of fingers being poked into the hole in the president's head. And of course, I guess we understand there was really no such thing as brain surgery per se.
Not at all. Brain surgery doesn't really begin until the early 20th century. And you had to master a great many issues, such as handling surgical shock and IV fluids and all sorts of things before you could invade the skull. And really, the point that the doctors were trying to do was to remove the clot and anything that might block the flow of blood, because they knew as that backed up and caused more pressure, it would cause more damage. So they knew the wound was mortal, but they were doing their best to try to delay the inevitable.
Was the president in pain? Was he at all conscious?
It doesn't seem by Leal's reports that he was conscious at all. His pulse was intermittent. He breathed laboriously. It sounds like he was unconscious, but there must have been some amount of pain. And certainly to his loved ones who were watching, there was a great deal of pain.
An anguishing night. Based on what we know about the wound and where it entered and the kind of injury that the president sustained, If that had happened today, would there have been any chance of the president surviving and recovering?
Very doubtful. And if he did recover, there would have been profound brain damage. It was quite an explosive event. And presidents or mere mortals don't do very well with bullet wounds to the brain. It was a really quite effective point-blank assassination.
A real interesting look at a very, very tragic night in American history and a tragic episode, the last hours of Abraham Lincoln. Dr. Howard Markel, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The chair Lincoln was sitting in that fateful night in D.C. ultimately made its way to Michigan. It's one of the most visited artifacts at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn. Patricia Moradian is the president of the Henry Ford. Patricia, what's happening this week?
So the Lincoln Chair is always in an exhibit called With Liberty and Justice for All, and it's in a airtight kind of case. And we are actually taking it out of the case for that one day, April 15th, tomorrow. And we are actually opening the museum for free to all guests all day so that they get to have an up-close experience and a rare moment on the museum floor with the chair that Lincoln was sitting in. It will be up on a pedestal, and it will, of course, have stanchions around it, but it will be in better view for all of our guests to see.
Describe the chair for us, would you, Patricia?
Well, it's very worn. It's like a reddish-colored rocker with a wood frame. It's a comfortable chair that President Lincoln was sitting in when he was at Ford Theater that night. Now, that wasn't a typical chair in the theater. They brought that. The owners of Ford Theater, no relation to Henry Ford, by the way, brought that chair in specifically from their home so the president would be watching the play in comfort that night.
Oh, boy. And then how did it get to Michigan? How did it come to be in the Henry Ford Museum collection?
And that's a good question. We get asked that quite a bit. After the assassination, the chair was taken away by the government, and it was used as evidence in the trial of the conspirators, the people who were working with Booth. It eventually wound up in a storage area in the Smithsonian Institution, and in 1929, it was actually reclaimed by the widow of Ford Theater because it was actually their property, and she reclaimed that, and then almost immediately turned around and sold it at auction. The buyer was an agent who acquired it for Henry Ford.
And Henry Ford was a great admirer, was he not, of Abraham Lincoln? Didn't he start collecting historic buildings by buying that Illinois courthouse where Lincoln was a lawyer?
When he actually collected that chair in 1929 was the year that the Henry Ford opened. And by then he was and had been restoring many significant buildings, brick by brick and board by board, so that people could have an experience, an immersive experience of learning about these tremendous, important people. And he really revered Lincoln. He revered all of the values of Lincoln. He had conviction and determination, and he had amazing values and was very self-educated. And these are all things Henry Ford could relate to and also that he admired quite a bit.
What do you hear from visitors? Why are we so drawn to these things that have these very tragic stories to tell us?
Well, you know, these artifacts are symbolic. They're symbolic of something that happened or some great person who did something or some ordinary person who did something that became great. And I think they're remembrances for us. And we always look here at the Henry Ford. We often say we're about the future, but you have to understand your past in order to make that better future. And these artifacts are emblematic of the past, and they're symbolic of some great characteristic or value or something that someone did. And it's a reminder to all of us, I think, and all of the visitors that we all can have conviction, we all can have vision, we can all be determined to do something to make a difference.
The Lincoln Chair, as Patricia said, will be displayed in this open area tomorrow, April 15th, also a free admission day at the Henry Ford Museum. And you can get all the information online at thehenryford.org and also look ahead to see what's coming up for the summer. Patricia Moradian, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
This is International Dark Sky Week. It's a good time to remember that Michigan is home to an international dark sky park, one of only 16 in the nation, and we have three dark sky preserves. Mary Stewart Adams is here with us now from Emmett County, from the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, right there along the shore of Lake Michigan near Mackinac City. Welcome back to Stateside, Mary.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
It has been a couple of years since we talked, and I know this, I still get people talking to me about our conversation about Headlands and wanting to know where it is. And I wondered, where do visitors come from to see the night skies minus light pollution?
They come from all over, and I mean all over the world. We have visitors from China and Turkey and Italy and from Mackinac City. They come from quite local, but everywhere, because unfortunately, a truly dark, naturally dark night sky is a diminishing resource around the world. But if you're in Michigan and you want to get to Headlands, the easiest thing to do is hop on I-75 from downstate. You just head north and you take the last exit before you're going over the Mackinac Bridge. That's in Mackinac City, and you turn left or west toward Lake Michigan. And we're 2 miles down the road. So very easy to get to us.
So easy. What kind of reactions do you get from visitors that particularly touch you?
Well, one of the most remarkable experiences actually happened last summer. There was a young man, I'd say he was in his early 20s. I mean, he was from Asia, and he had never seen the night sky. Now, I don't know how you get to be in your 20s without having that experience. And so he was holding very tightly to the arm of his girlfriend as they were coming down the steps from the parking area, and I was with them. So we were making sure that we really marked the moment when he got beyond the tree line and could actually look up and see the Milky Way arcing overhead with all of the brilliant stars. I think at least one of the planets was visible to him, and he was just awestruck. And really, he kind of started to cry. He was just stood there motionless. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment.
We have a lot of open space in Michigan, but I'm wondering your thoughts on what other places that don't have as much open land can do to turn down the light pollution and to protect their night sky.
Well, one of the first things you can do if you're a business owner or if you just own a residence is to turn on all of your lights and walk outside at night and look back at your home or your building and see where that light is going. And you can pick out in that situation whether or not the light is shining up where it's not needed, what lights you don't really need, and whether or not anything that's either inside or outside your structure is shining light into a neighbor's yard across the boundaries of your own property line. That's called light trespass, and that's some of the most offensive kind of light pollution for in neighborhoods and in communities.
I get the sense this is important, certainly in appreciating nature in the way you so beautifully described it, and also to stop wasting energy from unnecessary lights and giving off that light pollution.
Yeah, it's really a big part of the whole conversation, because at least a few years ago, statistically, the International Dark Sky Association was able to demonstrate that almost one-third of all of the light that's used at night, every night across the United States, is wasted because it's spilling up where it's not needed. Light that's going up is not illuminating anything. So if you translate that amount of light into dollars and cents, it ends up costing us about $2.2 billion a year in light that's just spilling up. And then when you translate that into the amount of energy that we have to generate in order to turn those lights on, and then consider the resources that we have to dig up out of the earth to create that amount of energy, it really becomes a very consequent issue.
You can go to michigan.gov/stateparks and click the purple graphic, and that'll give you details on how Headlands and our other state parks are marking International Dark Sky Week. Mary, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Mary Stewart Adams is with the International Dark Sky Park in Emmett County. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Crowdfunding. The word itself wasn't even known less than a decade ago. But crowdfunding's become a powerful way to raise money. Equity Net reports more than $20 billion in crowdfunding transactions will happen around the world this year. That's a 100% increase from last year. And the number of crowdfunding platforms and websites continues to grow. Indiegogo, GoFundMe, Kickstarter, Pledgy, Fundageek. You get the idea. But is it all too much? Michigan Radio social media producer Kimberly Springer is with us again. Hello, Kimberly.
Hi, Cindy.
How did crowdfunding initially get off the ground? Was it for startups? Was it for charities?
I think we first need to make a distinction between crowdfunding in real life and crowdfunding online.
Good point.
The pancake breakfast, the spaghetti dinner, all of these different kinds of benefits that we have always had to help one another out through institutions. So I think this form of crowdfunding online just makes it very visible to us that it's happening.
And it comes unbidden. I may choose to go to the KFC pancake breakfast or the church fish fry. I choose that. You know, go on Facebook and there it is as you scroll through. So it kind of comes unbidden in a way when it's online.
Well, sometimes it comes from your friends, right? I mean, it comes from people you know who are posting things, causes they're concerned about to your Facebook page. So, I mean, I think it did come from this idea of startups and people being able to invest in companies. And we've somehow managed to translate that into investing in one another. And in a lot of ways where institutions have failed us.
And so crowdfunding certainly gives individuals and charities and small groups a good and direct and free way to appeal to prospective donors. But then you wonder, is there a risk of crowdfunding fatigue?
Or compassion fatigue or any of these other ways that we might get tired of being asked?
All right. Just looking at some recent requests that I saw on Facebook, there is a crowdfunding campaign to save the 1910 vintage streetlights in Detroit's Indian Village neighborhood. There is an active campaign to help a couple of Detroit area techno musicians raise $4,000 to replace all the laptops and production gear that were stolen from their car. They can't make their music till they get the gear back. A campaign to move a Motown mural out of Northland Mall before it shuts down. An artist collective trying to buy a used bus. A musician trying to finish an album. And not saying that these are not all worthy causes, but we do seem to face that handout asking for money almost every time we go on Facebook.
And I think that's a key word there, is worthy. And does it somehow exhaust us psychically trying to figure out who or what is worthy of our money? So it's all individualized, I think, in terms of the hierarchy that we're creating in our heads of what's worthy.
Well, then I have to talk about Potato Salad Guy. And this is the guy that actually raised over $55,000 on Kickstarter from over 6,900 backers to make potato salad. Does something like that hurt the campaigns that are out there right now to raise money for funeral costs, to help a young husband recovering from traumatic brain injury from a motorcycle accident, or to help a family after a house fire? Is there room for Potato Salad Guy in this?
Well, I think didn't Potato Salad Guy end up giving most of the money to charity? So I think, you know, the person collecting has to have some sort of consciousness about what they're doing, because these different platforms are not necessarily going to do that for you. So, for example, GoFundMe, they took down a woman's campaign where she was trying to raise money to have an abortion. But yet they have other sorts of campaigns that are of dubious distinction, you know, to fund people who have criminal cases coming up. So, I mean, I think it's a wild and woolly place right now with the platforms themselves, because there's nothing like Charity Navigator for these crowdfunding platforms.
And
if you
that?
Go to Charity Navigator, it's a website where you can look and see, you can look up different organizations and figure out how much money they pay for overhead and how much money actually goes to the causes. And there's nothing like that for Kickstarter. There's no sort of vetting, really.
There isn't vetting. So where do you see this going?
I think people will always want to give, and I think it will probably just continue to splinter in the ways that it has. I mean, there are charities, there are people have health funds. There are projects for making films. So I think it will just continue along those lines of specialization. And it's going to be up to us to be just really conscious about, you know, what makes us feel good in our giving and who do we want to help?
Yeah. And perhaps thinking long and hard about where you want to put your request and whether the request is worthy. And if you all you have to go to do is find the Tumblr page of all the requests that got zero to get an idea of kind of maybe what the public isn't buying.
Right.
Interesting. Kimberly Springer is Michigan Radio's social media producer and our guide to all things online. Thanks, Kimberly.
You're welcome.
Can science fiction be a form of social activism? My next two guests say, you bet. And the proof is a project called Octavia's Brood. It's a science fiction anthology, and it's being launched this week in Detroit. Adrienne Marie Brown is here now with us. She's a Kresge Literary Fellow, a sci-fi writer, and co-editor of Octavia's Brood. Welcome.
It's great to be with y'all.
And we have Flint performance artist Tunde Olunniran back with us on Stateside, and he actually has a story in the Octavia's Brood anthology. Good to have you back, Tunde.
So excited to be back.
Adrian, the anthology's title is a nod to Octavia Butler, who is a sci-fi legend. Can you talk a bit about her legacy and who she is?
I could talk almost endlessly about her. Octavia Butler was a Black science fiction writer, really the first recognized Black female science fiction writer. She won a MacArthur Award. She published 12 novels and a collection of short stories. And her work was really unique in that she focused on young Black female protagonists, for the most part, having first contact with aliens who were surviving apocalypse, who were time traveling, and who were constantly adapting to new conditions. Her protagonists were not only unique in their identity, but unique in the way that they approached changing the world around them.
And Tunde, I know you're kind of just, you light up too when I said her name.
I'm a big film person. I also love Octavia Butler, Ursula K. Le Guin, but women or people of color are not often the protagonist in any story that you see. You know, something as big as The Hunger Games, you're still a peripheral character. Maybe you have a death scene that's very elegant, but you're not, you know, the main character. And so,
and Star Trek, you're Lieutenant Uhura standing on the bridge.
Right. I mean, you get a little bit more love now that you're Zoe Saldana. But
yes.
I still think that, you know, it's really important to vision a future where you exist, you know? So to me, that's why Octavia's legacy is so important.
I'm interested if you could give us a sense when you talk about mainstream science fiction, and now we're kind of talking about this visionary social activism science fiction. How do they differ?
What I would say is that with Octavia's Brood specifically, we have authors who are not only envisioning, but they're doing the work to build a different future or to build their version of justice, their version of equity, their version of, you know, love in a world that is safe for them. And so you get those elements that are connected.
One of the things we've been calling our work is visionary fiction. And a reason we've made that distinction is because within the science fictional world, you can go off to another planet, you can go off to another place, and still have all of the same power dynamics play out that we experience in the here and now without much experimentation. But because everyone's like a green alien, you know, we can get away with it being a patriarchal, hierarchical society and not be too pressured. And so one of the things we wanted to say was, why don't we explicitly write visionary fiction where we decenter the hero narrative, where one person comes in and saves the day, or we explicitly explore change from the bottom up. What does that actually look like in practice? How do we have to relate to each other and be interdependent with each other in order for that to work? How do we center marginalized people in the stories that we tell? What we see a lot in current films and big sci-fi productions is this whole city got obliterated, right, so that the hero could have their moment, but that city is probably full of workers and people. Yeah. And so in our stories, it's like, well, the action is going to happen with those workers and people. Mm. And if anyone gets obliterated, it's going to be the sort of singular characters who don't have a community around them to care for them, and then we can learn from that.
Yeah, and I think, too, like when you look at even something current like a movement surrounding the phrase Black Lives Matter, right?
Yeah.
And I think what's really special about that is that it is a decentralized movement. And I think you see pressure from people to, like, pick out, well, Al Sharpton is, but even folks who are doing that organizing are like, Al Sharpton is not a representative, you know?
Right,
and so
see... Nobody can co-opt it.
Exactly. And you see parallels in terms of how you organize and the kind of work that Adrian and Walida are doing with this anthology and then some of the workshops that they do is exploring how movement building can be different than one hero coming in and saving the day or one figure coming in and telling everyone, you know, how to live.
So looking at Octavia's Brood, and I know that Adrian, I know Tunde was saying when you reached out to him, so I know you're a real heartbeat of this project. How many stories and who are some of the writers?
Myself and my co-editor, Walida E. Marisha, we gathered these stories from our favorite people in the world. Basically, we were like, who do we think is doing some of the most incredible work in the world? Folks like Tunde who are doing like reproductive justice work, but also artists, but also activists, you know, like who walk this line. We have 22 stories in it. Two of them are essays, one of which is by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is currently in a fight for his life here in Pennsylvania, where I am. And the other by Tananarive Due, which is about her interaction with Octavia and The rest of them are incredible stories. So we have some that are by established science fiction writers, LeVar Burton, who many of y'all know as Geordi from Star Trek.
Tune Day is just raising the roof for
super, super geeked out about that.
Yeah.
We have Terry Bisson, who wrote Fire on the Mountain. We excerpted that. We have Kalamu Wassalam. And then we have a lot of pieces by folks who have never written fiction or science fiction before. That's, to me, the heart of this project. Our premise is that we believe all organizing is science fiction. If you're trying to recreate the new world, that's a science fictional activity. And so we ask the people who we see as being on the front lines of this new world to tell us the horizon that they see. The stories are just incredible.
Tundi, tell us a little about the story that you contributed.
I'm a first-time writer, and I wrote a story called Little Brown Mouse. And it's actually kind of horror science fiction. It's a little scary.
Indeed.
Yeah. I think it's one of the few that really are like that. But it's a main character who is being haunted by something or an apparition, and he's also grappling with some abilities that he doesn't quite understand, and he's had tried to control through medication, institutionalized medicine, you know, but it didn't quite work. And eventually that haunting apparition breaking through and communicating. For me, it was kind of a parallel to not just personal growth, but like if you have certain strengths that you thought were really like weaknesses or things that marginalized you, like mm-hmm. those things can actually be something that can change the world around you. So it's spooky and scary. It was my first time writing. I was really nervous. And I actually got to read a lot of the stories because I'm writing we're doing a live score for the release. So we have a quintet that we've gotten of a harpist, theremin player, viola, singers. It's a really cool collection of people, but I had to read stories to write the score to them. And they're so great. The stories are so interesting. I have my personal favorites. There's one story about what would happen if we passed a law that said because of the level of destruction of our environment, people can no longer travel outside of a certain radius. So you need to pick where you live for the next decade. The story was written so well that it felt like, yeah, this could actually happen. And the voice of it was very contemporary feeling.
And I want to hear more now. And Adrienne, tell us about what's happening this Saturday. It's April 18th. You're kind of launching everything as part of ArtX Detroit. What will be happening at the Garden Theater?
It's going to be the biggest launch event that we're having in the country. We are flying in six of the writers, contributors. Walita will be in as the other co-editor. And we're doing this multidimensional reading. Tunde mentioned it's going to have a musical element to it. Mm-hmm. We also have short films that were created by the James and Grace Lee Boggs School youth about futures that they are projecting for 2026 and 2050 and their ideas. It's going to be amazing, I think, to get to hear these writers sharing these stories and weaving them into each other, because I think the stories are so different. But then together, you start to have this impression that there are so many universes out there amongst those who are thinking about justice. The other element will be that I hosted a series of local sci-fi writing salons in Detroit. And so we've invited a few of the folks who wrote for the first time in those spaces to come out and read some of their work. It's going to be an opportunity to get all of the writers and contributors who are there to sign books. Mm-hmm. So those books will be of utmost value somehow. And then we're going to party.
Yeah, that's the most important part.
Which is like the part to me that has been really important is like the radical space to celebrate each other. And there's so much you can communicate on a dance floor and just in your body. And the joy of this project, the joy of like being in future orientation together is so amazing. Two of my favorite DJs coming through to spin for us. Tunde is going to do a performance for us, which is always my favorite thing.
It's worth telling everyone you can find out more information not only about the anthology Octavia's Brood, but this event at the website, which is octaviasbrood.com. It's all one word mm-hmm. with no apostrophe,
yeah.
octaviasbrood.com. What advice would each of you give to activists in Michigan, but also those who have it in their heart to maybe want to write science fiction? Tundi, this was your first piece of written science fiction. What would you tell somebody that's harboring that feeling inside?
I feel like Adrian might say something similar, but I would say start, just start something. I'm a perfectionist, and so it's really hard for me to dive into something that I'm unfamiliar with. But once I sat down and just spent a day, just write your character, write the setting, think about, you know, what really happens in this story. For me, that was the biggest hurdle, was actually taking the step to like put pen to paper or cursor to keyboard or cursor to screen, whatever, to start that.
How about you, Adrienne?
I would say ditto on that. And the only addition I would say is find someone to write with or a group of people to write with. One of the things we're finding is that people do need that little push of permission to really unleash their imagination. Yeah. And sometimes that comes from just being heard and affirmed in your concepts or your ideas. You know, getting together as a group, spending some time thinking of, like, what are some prompts or what's a world that we'd like to build in and write in, and then write together and share what you come out with and get the feedback. I like to set up scenarios where the feedback all has to be positive. Just tell me how great and brilliant I am, because I'm still learning and I want to really be encouraged. And I like to create that kind of space for people. Take yourself seriously as a writer. Give time to it. Build community around it. It can be a part of your life that then bleeds into everything else in a beautiful way.
Exploring peace, justice, and social activism through the form of science fiction that we're calling visionary fiction, and it's embodied in this project called Octavia's Brood, this anthology. Adrienne Marie Brown is co-editor of Octavia's Brood, also a Kresge Literary Fellow and a science fiction writer, and Flint performance artist Tunde Olanirin, who has his debut science fiction story in Octavia's Brood. You can learn more about the big celebration and unveiling this Saturday at the Garden Theater in Detroit at octaviasbrood.com. Both of you, thank you so much. It was a blast to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstroth, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.